Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. We have another super weekend this week because it's another superhero movie coming out. We just had one a couple weeks ago with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which wasn't terribly super, but now we have X-Men Days of Future Past. We also have Blended as counter-programming. We have Belle as more counter-programming. And then you have The Hornet's Nest, which is pretty appropriate. Simply, it's Memorial Day weekend, and we also don't want to, you know, forget about our servicemen and women serving and who have served and those that we've lost. So The Hornet's Nest is a good piece of viewing for Memorial Day weekend. We'll talk more about those in the later parts of the show. We're also going to be having some news, and we're going to be talking about a couple new trailers that have hit recently, and the box office, what happened last week, what's going to happen next week, and the DVD roundup to find out what you can get for home video options this week. If you want to get a hold of me, you can send me an email at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the interwebs at fatguysatthemovies.com and at facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. We're all over the place. And if you want to find me personally, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr and interact with me there.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. We are moving into the news segment. There's actually quite a bit of things going on in it. There's some superhero and Star Wars news, but there's some other things we want to talk about. First of all, in the superhero realm, we have Batman versus Superman. That movie finally gets a name. Of course, back when I was a kid, they just say whatever the movie 2 and put a number 2 or the Roman letter 2 after it. Now they always have to have some long subtitle. And this is what's so weird about this movie. It's a Man of Steel sequel. And the only reason I think it's the Man of Steel sequel is it's more of the start of a series. I wouldn't call it necessarily a sequel to Man of Steel, but it continues that specific universe. This sort of carves the Nolanverse into another category. So it's, of course, Ben Affleck is Batman coming into that universe. But now it's got a title, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, which is a terrible title. Well, it's not a terrible title. I mean, you know, Batman vs. Superman, Fuzzy Kittens might be a worse title. The obvious title would have been World's Finest, which has meant Superman and Batman for decades, better part of a century, since they started making Batman and Superman teaming up back in the 40s and 50s. But I guess since they're fighting each other, they're at odds, they're not going to be World's Finest yet. And of course, this spins off into another series. Part of the problem is they're still playing catch-up. DC is so disastrously behind the box office train on this one that they're scrambling to make this work. I mean, you don't can't tell much from a title, but it's aside from the fact that it's not a terribly good one. The next piece of news, we're filing under duh, and this is that Godzilla 2 is in development, which is usually an announcement you hear before the movie's released. But since Godzilla did so well last weekend, they're saying, hey, why not? Let's make another one. And apparently Gareth Edwards is going to be involved in some way. I think he's actually scheduled to do two other Godzilla movies. You know, maybe he'll get his act together for these and actually deal with more of the monsters than the boring human characters. There'll be fewer shots of Elizabeth Olsen just staring at something. Also, in Gareth Edwards news, he has been tapped to direct a Star Wars spinoff. Nobody knows which one it is, because we talked a couple weeks ago about there's going to be a Boba Fett movie, a Yoda movie, a Han Solo movie. My friend Edward Douglas from ComingSoon.net made a joke. I have to give him credit, because I was going to make this joke on the air, but he made it before the show. And he basically said, oh, which a character is going to be showing up for 10 minutes in this movie. So if he does this the way he did Godzilla, you're going to have Boba Fett, and it's not actually going to be about Boba Fett. He's just going to show up occasionally, and they'll cut away from him and deal with boring characters played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Elizabeth Olsen. So I still think he's unproved. He did Godzilla. This might be a fluke, but we'll see. You know, I hope that he takes to heart the criticisms he's getting, even from the people who like the movie. And the other part of this is he's going to be working for Disney, who is running the Star Wars franchise, so he's going to be handled. If you look at the Marvel movies, all these movies, you know, the Captain America and its sequel and Thor and its sequel, these and all the Iron Man movies, they all kind of have the same feel to them. So there's a lot of control being held by the studio here, and I think that's a good thing to kind of keep the flavor in the right direction. The other couple development stories we have is the movie It, which was a book by Stephen King, who I maligned in a couple episodes ago. But I loved It, and it was made into a miniseries about 25 years ago, starring Tim Curry as Pennywise the Clown. He's an iconic-looking character. No, nobody remembers the TV movie that much, and kind of what a partial disaster that was, but everyone remembers Tim Curry as Pennywise. They're going to be making an It movie at New Line, which is great. I hope they get Tim Curry, because I think he could play it again. I think that would be awesome. But of course, they probably won't, and they'll probably make him the CGI clown. Alfonso Cuarón is going to be directing Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the Harry Potter spinoff. This is the first piece of news of this that makes me anticipate the movie, because everything else before this point felt like a needless cash grab, and it still is. But Cuarón's such a fantastic filmmaker, and he helped set the Harry Potter franchise on the right track with The Prisoner of Azkaban. The fact that he's involved in this, I'm now saying, okay, now I feel like they could do something with this beyond the Harry Potter franchise instead of just making sort of languish there and be substandard compared to the other films. Last piece of news is that J.J. Abrams has released a video from the set of Star Wars Episode 7, where he's asking people to give to charity, give to UNICEF, in Force for Change, and basically the gist of it is you go to, you search Force for Change, you know, Star Wars Episode 7, and you can donate $10 to the cause, and they'll, like, I guess, doing a raffle of some sort, will pick a winner of that to have a walk-on spot in the new Star Wars movie that will probably get edited out eventually. That's the reality of the world. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are moving into the trailer park. Beep, beep, beep. The first one I want to hit is The 100-Foot Journey. Now, this stars Helen Mirren, Dame Helen Mirren, who is still one sexy lady. I'll tell you, she is. I am not somebody who goes after women twice my age, or, you know, 40% older than me. But I would put aside the chance to, you know, have a little roll in the hay with Helen Mirren. But that's nothing. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm talking crass language about an Academy Award winning actress, a national treasure in multiple countries. But anyways, The 100-Foot Journey opens August 8th. And here's the trailer.
100 feet across the street, the restaurant has a Michelin star. The President of France dines there.
Can Mr. President order murgh masala cooked the way Hassan cooks?
People here don't eat those things.
They have never tried. Now they shall.
Is it a wedding party over there?
A funeral. The death of good taste.
If your food is anything like your music, I suggest you turn it down.
This looks like a fun little movie. It reminds me a bit of The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, where it's just this very sweet, sort of nice old person movie, I guess you could say. And it's obvious, again, that Hollywood is trying to woo the Indian audience, which is a massive audience of people who just love movies. So they're trying to find their own American mark on Bollywood. But this looks decent, right? I mean, it's going to be, I think, exactly what you expect. Coming up next is Interstellar, which opens November 7th. Now, this is Christopher Nolan's upcoming film.
You're a well-educated man, Coop, and a trained pilot.
And an engineer.
The world doesn't need any more engineers. We didn't run out of planes and television sets. We ran out of food.
We're not meant to save the world. We're meant to leave it. And this is the mission we were trained for.
I am a little bit nervous about this movie. And the reason is, and it's the trailer that does it, this movie doesn't look like it's going to be anything but a bunch of people sitting around talking. And that has not been Christopher Nolan's strong point. It was when he did The Following, which was his first movie he did in England. And it worked for stuff like Memento, but there doesn't seem to be much of a story here aside from just a lot of hand-wringing with the characters. And that's not why I go see a Christopher Nolan movie. And it may have some, and maybe there's a lot more to it. Maybe what we see in this trailer is just teasing the first, you know, third of the movie. And maybe there's some great stuff and fantastic, speculative, wide open thoughts for the next 2 hours of the movie. But this, ultimately, this trailer really leaves me kind of cold. So that's it. We got to go. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Belle and the Hornet's Nest. We'll be right back. are with Fat Guys in the Movies rolling on in. We are going to be doing the smaller movies in this segment before we hit the big ones, because everyone wants to talk about X-Men. Not everyone wants to talk about Adam Sandler, but everybody wants to talk about X-Men. But I'm not going to talk about X-Men yet. You're going to have to wait, because there's a couple other movies that are always kind of worth noting, simply because these are not the top tier films. These are smaller movies and often less seen movies. First one is Belle. Born into slavery, a woman of mixed race is adopted by her aristocratic family and raised as their own with various societal conditions.
Papa, how may I be too high in rank to dine with the servants and too low to dine with my family?
Though I understand she is kept under interesting rules, she raises questions.
Would you do me the honor of taking some air with me?
Don't you care what people will say?
What should anyone say?
I have no idea she would be so black.
One does not make a wife of the rare and exotic.
Does she still have a tongue?
I have a tongue.
Though yours explains well enough why I may not marry your son.
I am not a fan of the costume drama. I'm not a fan of movies about the idle rich. And that's essentially what these characters are. They're not super rich, but, you know, the Tom Wilkinson's plays their father figures, really their uncle. And he's a lawyer at the time. And they, of course, parallel this with this monumental case of British law where a slave ship had killed its inventory, basically. Whether or not that's legal and how that impacts the slave trade going forward. So it has much greater implications than just this tiny little drama within the people in this house. And I apologize if I butcher her name. But it stars Gugu Mbatha-Raw, I think is how you say her name. She was in Doctor Who. She played Martha Jones' sister. And she was also in that short-lived J.J. Abrams show, Undercovers. And she was in that awful Tom Hanks movie, Larry Crown. She was a pseudo-love interest that wasn't Julia Roberts. She's actually really good. She's a beautiful woman, and she can play that very prim and proper British. She's British, so, I mean, she kind of comes at that naturally. And it's got a great cast. She does a great job. You've got Tom Wilkinson as the father figure, and you've got Emily Watson as the mother figure and the aunt and uncle. You've got Tom Felton playing, once again, some smarmy little British dude who's entitled and having problems dealing with the fact that he's just a big roaring pain in the tush. This movie is made for people who love that stiff corset tightened costume drama. It's not a bodice ripper or anything like that. So, I mean, it's very straight-laced. And it's sort of like for the Downton Abbey crowd. If you love that drama where there's a very proper British drama, and even the most stinging insults are told with an air of sophistication and respect, that is what you get in this movie. And it's very dramatic, but it's all stuffed into that corset. And you feel like, after you leave the movie, you feel like you've been in a corset the entire time, because it is so stiff and prim and proper, but that's the way it was. I mean, it is sort of like you do kind of roll your eyes and being like, oh, how tough is it to be wealthy? Oh, I need to find a husband. But that's the nature of these movies. And like, it's not my cup of tea, but I know a lot of people who love those kind of films. And it does something a little bit unique, because it does deal with the racial issues, and it makes very obvious parallels, the things that are going on with race relations today. And obviously, they're as bad as race relations can be at times. They're nothing like they were in the 1800s. I don't think anybody is arguing that. Well, there might be some crazy people out there arguing this, but I don't think anyone's ever arguing that the race relations of the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s, were preferable to the problems we have today. But that's not to say that there aren't still problems. This has an interesting take on the costume drama, and it gives something a little bit different, and has some great performances. So I'm going to say that this film officially kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I'm going to be talking about, this is for Memorial Day weekend. It's opening in limited release, and it's going to be rolling out throughout the country. It actually is opening in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, this weekend. And it's a good movie to see for Memorial Day, because as much as we have movies that honor fallen Americans and the Americans out there fighting in whose our boots are on the ground, and they tend to be sometimes overly flag wavy, like Act of Valor was a bit flag wavy at times, and sometimes they get to be, they're very hard to watch, stuff like Lone Survivor, but this one is a documentary, and that's the reason it's worth seeing, is because it shows the reality, as opposed to the hyper reality that Hollywood puts out. So anyways, in the Hornet's Nest, embedded journalist Mike Betcher brings his son on a mission to connect with him and later gets pinned down in a dangerous extended firefight.
No one's ever dared to go in there.
I don't think anybody was prepared for what it was going to be like. Some of us had the worst in mind.
They're fighting not only for this war on terror. They're fighting for their fellow soldiers.
This is literally shot at the point of action. And the real push of this movie is how they end up at this firefight and how dangerous it is and how it just goes on for days. And what's fascinating about this movie is if you've seen something like, say, Lone Survivor, and then you watch The Hornet's Nest, your jaw will drop at how realistic and how authentic the scenery looks in Lone Survivor. Because in Lone Survivor, it looks like it was shot at the same place. Now, obviously, it wasn't. This was shot literally in the fighting of Afghanistan, whereas Lone Survivor was shot on a location. But Peter Berg, it really made me respect what Peter Berg did with Lone Survivor in making it a realistic, at least layout of what it's like in that area of the world. And I mean, with the mountains and the trees and how difficult it is to get around. The drawback is for somebody like me who's not in the military, and I've never been in the military, I'm not coming from a military family, there's a lot of stuff that I just don't understand, because this is not simple stuff. The military campaign in Afghanistan is not just pushing pawns around a board of risk or something like that. It's complex, and there's societal things, and you're dealing with, I don't know who these people they're going after are, and they're trying to explain it, but it's really lost on me, because you're dealing with different cultures, different worlds, and operations that are far beyond my pay grade. This is such a hard film to digest in terms of the details. But it gets you there to the emotional point, which is with the people embedded there and stuck and the attempts to get them out. And while it's not as explodey and gratuitous as a Hollywood film is, it's realistic because it's happening. And when you hear a bullet go ping by, you know that that's a real bullet and that's just not a sound effect. So it does a great job at, honoring the heroes and honoring the people involved in these operations. The real drawback I have on this is because Mike Betcher is an embedded journalist and he's been doing it for years, there is sometimes a temptation from journalists to make the story about them. And Betcher does that a lot. The first half of the movie is how he's bringing his estranged son with him on these missions. And of course he's putting his son in danger. I mean, his son's in his 20s, so it's not like bringing a 12-year-old into this. So he brings him along and at one point they do get caught in kind of another firefight, and you can see him worried about his son. And I'm like, well, I understand that helps ground it as saying, hey, that, you know, stuff got real at this point. But you're around people that do this all the time. Every day you're going out there and endangering yourself. And then especially near the end, where it's really emotional and it's about what's happening with the aftermath of this event, it suddenly, of course, Betcher has to come in and have to bring it about himself. And then that gets a little bit crass at times. But still, for the impact and for the context, it is a good movie to see. So I'm going to say that The Hornet's Nest kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Next, we're going to be talking about X-Men Days of Future Past and Blended, but right now, I need to hear a word from our sponsors. We are back with Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr, and we're moving into the Days of Future Past. We're going to be talking about the latest X-Men movie. Before I even talk about the movie itself, this is kind of a fascinating series in itself, even if you don't like the movies, or there's some you don't like in particular. I tend to have liked all the X-Men movies. Ironically, my least favorite was last summer's The Wolverine. That's the one I just didn't like the most. Yes, I liked X-Men Origins Wolverine better than The Wolverine. Sue me. I'm sorry. This is coming out almost 14 years to the day after the first one came out in 2000. And people forget that it was X-Men that launched the modern superhero franchise, because X-Men came out just 3 years after Batman and Robin, which is probably considered, along with Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, some of the worst superhero movies ever made. And X-Men set the bar. Bryan Singer, the director, wanted to make this not a cartoony movie, which obviously Batman and Robin was. Now it's hard to conceive of what the world was like in 2000 before these movies started coming out, because we had the whole Dark Knight and Marvel Cinematic Universe series. But had X-Men not come out, you may not have gotten the Christopher Nolan Batman series. You may not have gotten the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the Avengers and Iron Man. So this is a significant series. And there have been 6 movies so far. This is the 7th. And it stars, of course, Hugh Jackman. And Hugh Jackman's played him. I think he's played him more than any person has played a superhero in the modern age. You know, no one else has ever played Wolverine. It shows his how long the series has been going on. And they got a lot of the familiar faces back. Yeah, there's some people who aren't from the original movie. I mean, different Kitty Pryde, now played by Ellen Page. This is a bit of history because we're kind of coming full circle. And in X-Men Days of Future Past, in order to save mutants and the human race as a whole, Wolverine has to travel into the past to convince Charles Xavier and Magneto to stop Mystique from assassinating a political figure.
I was sent here for you.
From the future?
50 years from now.
Could you give me that one more time, please?
Stay with me.
In the beginning, the Sentinels were just targeting mutants. Then they began targeting everyone. They've come a long way to guide us, to bring us together. The X-Men, we need your help.
Tell whoever it was that sent you, I'm busy.
The person who sent me was you.
First of all, I love time travel stories anyways, even if they're sort of like pseudo time travel stories, because Wolverine doesn't actually travel. It's sort of like his mind goes to his past mind. But of course, it deals with time travel. And I know there are some people that hate time travel movies. You're just going to have to, if you don't like time travel movies, probably don't go see it, because it deals with a lot of that. And I never read the original book series, the bits of X-Men Days of Future Past that actually came out in comic book form. But what I love about how it works with the movies is it really bridges the original X-Men movies, X-Men, X-Men United, and X-Men The Last Stand. It bridges those with X-Men First Class, which was that prequel that came out a couple years ago. So you've got these same characters, same actors playing the roles, and it kind of merges these two universes and kind of makes them one. And Bryan Singer's done some real crap lately. I mean, let's face it. Bryan Singer has done some great movies, but he has done movies like Jack the Giant Slayer. He did Valkyrie, which was just okay. He did Superman Returns and killed that franchise for almost, 8 years. It's him returning to the X-Men series, and I think he's really got a handle on this series. He does a great job with this movie. This movie is paced extremely well. There's just enough inside jokes to keep the fans, and I'm not talking about the fans of the books, I'm talking about the fans of the series, of the movies, to keep the fans of the movies chuckling to themselves and getting something more than just your average viewer. It helps to go into this movie having watched all the other 6 movies, which I did. My kids and I, over their spring break, we watched all 6 X-Men movies. And we do that a lot. We're going to be watching all the Star Wars movies this summer with Indiana Jones. This movie is probably one of the best X-Men movies out there. Now, I mean, I love X-Men 2. I think that's a fantastic film. And I love First Class. I thought those were kind of the high points of the series. And this one is right up there with it. It's well-paced. It runs about 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's a longer movie, but it doesn't feel like it drags at all. What's neat about this is because X-Men's kind of moved all the way into pop culture, you don't have to explain who mutants are. And this guy's Wolverine. He's got claws and this happens. And you don't have to explain who Professor X is or Magneto. You don't have to go through an explanation, because there have been 6 movies, for crying out loud. If you don't know who Magneto is and that he can control metal, then you're so behind the times. Go watch something else. So you can kind of hit the ground running with this movie. And it's great. I think it really, really works. And what it does is it's doing exactly what the Spider-Man series is not. It is making bigger and better movies that have potential to branch out and make full-blown series as opposed to just one-off films. So X-Men Days of Future Past totally rocks. Go see it.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Blended. Adam Sandler reunites with Drew Barrymore as single parents to go on an African vacation and learn to deal with each other's families.
Look at that. Africa. Sun, sand, safaris.
My boys would give anything to go on a vacation like this.
No more dating for me. It's time and money I should be spending with my kids.
This is pretty cool, Mom.
What'd you see doing here?
Is this a sick dream?
Why have a new mommy?
Isn't this place fantastic? So romantic.
We are not dating.
My mom is hot.
Ew. No, not hot.
That's just wrong.
Adam Sandler has been responsible for some of the worst movies that have come out in recent history. Over the last 4 or 5 years, he has given us Grown Ups, Grown Ups 2, Jack and Jill, That's My Boy. He has made some really, really terrible movies. Which is a shame because his earlier works actually not bad. I mean, Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison, those are funny movies. And when he worked with Drew Barrymore on The Wedding Singer and 51st States, those were good movies too. I don't know what happened here to Adam Sandler in his career post-2007, 2008. But his stuff has been terrible. With that said, there's an interesting twist to this story. I don't know whether it's reuniting with Drew Barrymore or whether it's changing studios from Columbia, which did a lot of the crap, and going to Warner Brothers. I don't know if the studio had any control over it. I don't know if it was dumping director Dennis Dugan, who did some decent movies with Adam Sandler in the, you know, years ago, like Big Daddy. Yeah, and I think he did Happy Gilmore, which was a funny movie. But Dennis Dugan does garbage now. So he got rid of Dennis Dugan. He's working with Frank Caracci, who some people might have problems because he did The Zookeeper. But he also did Here Comes the Boom, which isn't a bad movie. I mean, it didn't do well, but I actually thought Here Comes the Boom was decent. I don't know what the element was that made this actually work, but this movie's not bad. And I mean, compared to Grown Ups and Grown Ups 2 and Jack and Jill, this is Citizen Kane, for crying out loud. Now, it's still just a middling movie. It's a decent film. It's not great. It has serious logic and flow problems. It has, some jokes don't stick at all. They fall flat. And it's got some things that don't quite work. And there's some pacing issues and there's logic holes. But you know what? It's got heart. And that's part of what was missing. Maybe it's because all the other his movies, since like Funny People, he always played some guy who, for whatever reason, was independently wealthy and had the hottest wife in the world or just always got chicks. And he'd get women along the level of like Brooklyn Decker. This one, he's just playing an average guy. He's playing a widower who works at a sporting goods store who's trying to raise his daughters. And he's not perfect. He doesn't have a whole lot of money. And that actually works. I mean, somehow, I don't know what it is. And it also doesn't hurt to have Drew Barrymore in there because I've always had a soft spot for her. I think she's really turned her life around, obviously, from her drug days when she was like before she could drive. But she's very charming in it as well and very accessible, too. And here's the thing with Drew Barrymore. Yeah, she was in Playboy when she was younger, but Drew Barrymore is a very accessible person. She's not gorgeous model type, and she's not super thin. And I mean, she kind of looks like an everyday person, and that's okay. And that, I think, works well for her. And that makes her very endearing, and this makes this movie somewhat realistic. I thought it was very charming. And there are times when I'm just like, okay, that's funny. That's a funny scene. Those are funny lines. Yeah, so for counter-programming, it's a perfectly fine film, you know. Blended, believe it or not, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
All right, with that, I need to go to a break. We're going to be talking about box office and the DVD roundup coming up next.
Shake that.
Fat Guys at the Movies, wrapping up with Kevin Carr here. After talking about all these films that are coming out that you can go check out in the theaters, let's talk a little bit about what happened last week in the movie theaters. This little film, this little independent film with this little critter in it called Godzilla, it won the weekend. I don't think anyone is surprised by the fact that it won the weekend. I think everyone was expecting it to win the weekend. It overplayed expectations. People were thinking maybe in the $70 to $80 million range. I actually said $88 million for Godzilla, and I thought that was kind of the high end. It ended up doing better than that. It made $93 million. Which is a fantastic score for The Big Lizard. The one thing I do find interesting about Godzilla is even the people that love the movie, they do come out and kind of say the same things that I said bothered me about it. And if you recall, I gave it a kind of rocks review. I remember saying, well, you know, there wasn't enough Godzilla and they really need to fix that. And they need to fix the fact that we don't need to be cutting away from Godzilla every time something cool is about to happen. So, yeah, $93 million, it's a big monster at the box office. Let's see how well it does against the X-Men movie coming up. And then, of course, you've got other things happening in the next couple of weeks. I think this is going to be a summer of first weekends, and the big, huge movies are going to have lesser legs because there's always something big coming out. You know, like next week is Maleficent, and that's going to steal from everybody as well as you know, X-Men's going to steal from everybody this weekend. Million Dollar Arm came out with $10.5 million, which is fine because I think these are the kinds that are going to have legs. The smaller movies, the family-oriented stuff that aren't the big, huge blockbusters that are going to make half or you know, 40% of their total that first weekend, you're going to have these Million Dollar Arm movies. Yeah, it only made $10.5 million, but I think it's going to have relatively small drops just because it's out there and it's something different. And you're not going to get anything like it until you get the 100-foot journey that we talked about earlier. Legends of Oz has dumped and fallen down. It hasn't even cracked $7 million. It's the lowest gross from an animated film that opened as wide as it did. And what's interesting is there's this big feud going on behind the scenes. The producers, they ended up getting investors at $100,000 a piece. They got 1,000 people, apparently, to give them $100,000 each to make this and its sequel. I don't know if the sequel's going to happen. But I don't know, 100 people who would just be able to write me a check for $100,000, even if it's the greatest idea ever. I don't even know 10 people. How do you find 1,000 people to give you $100,000 each? He's going around, the producer's going around, accusing there's this giant Hollywood cabal that was conspiring to give terrible reviews to this movie. And apparently I'm part of that cabal because he was citing the Rotten Tomatoes score. Because then I get indexed on Rotten Tomatoes. Look, I can tell you, I authentically did not like this movie. I thought it wasn't that good. I haven't gotten my paycheck from the great Hollywood cabal. So I don't know. Maybe it's caught in the mail. Who knows? Anyways, this weekend, obviously X-Men's going to win the box office. For the 4-day, because it's a 4-day weekend, because you hit Memorial Day, which is always a huge movie day, I really think it's going to be at $120 million when all said and done. Because this is getting great reviews. There's always been a rocky road for X-Men. It hasn't been the huge juggernaut that, say, the Spider-Man series or the Dark Knight series had been. But I think it's good enough, and it's recognizable enough, and it brings everything back, and the release date helps. It's Memorial Day weekend. I think you're going to get a lot of people seeing this, and so many people saw Godzilla last week, they're ready to watch something else. Because American audiences are fickle, and they always want something new. So I'm thinking $120 million for the 4-day weekend of X-Men Days of Future Past. You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. We do not have a response to a listener email or phone call, but I have a response to something I saw some of my listeners talking about on Facebook. And you know who you are when I talk about this. Two listeners I know in particular were arguing about whether Guardians of the Galaxy is going to bomb. And one of them's like, it's going to bomb. It's going to be terrible. No one's going to watch it. And the other one's like, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be this great. It's poised to be the biggest movie of the summer. I mean, I'm exaggerating each of their claims. This is a very hard topic to tackle because the definition of bomb is so squinchy in Hollywood. The success of a movie is more dependent on what the studio is expecting. So you have to look at what their expectations are. You don't have to look at their budget. You have to look, well, I mean, you do, but you have to look at what their expectations are. Guardians of the Galaxy is not going to be an Iron Man movie. Everyone's like, oh, it's not going to make as much as Iron Man. Well, it's not going to. For no other reason, the release date is the biggest reason why it's not going to. Every single Iron Man movie and the Avengers movie all came at the first weekend of May, which is one of the biggest opening weekend days of the summer. That and like 4th of July. Those are the big, huge opening weekend days. Guardians of the Galaxy opens August 1st, but it's still an August release. And August releases historically are not huge releases. There have only been four movies, which is The Bourne Ultimatum, Rush Hour 2, Signs, and The Sixth Sense, that have even cracked $200 million domestically in August releases. People are comparing it to Watchmen, but you can't because that's R-rated, and that came out in like March. And it was a Warner Brothers DC property that they didn't have the buildup of all the other, you know, Marvel stuff behind it. It's also, people are comparing it to Kick-Ass. But again, you can't compare that because it's a very different film. Kick-Ass was squarely geared for the grown-up or older audiences. This is a space opera. It's a Star Wars kind of movie. People compare it to Scott Pilgrim. But again, Scott Pilgrim, because, oh, they're saying it's a smaller comic book, lesser known. But Scott Pilgrim wasn't just a smaller comic book. It was a fringe comic book that had a rabid following. But it had a very small audience. And while people don't generally know the Guardians of the Galaxy, it's a much wider net. It's not for sort of that, it's not that hipster culture that's just going for one very small segment of society. This is a broad movie. There's really no comparable movie like this that's come out in August. It's PG or PG-13 and it's aimed for that audience. So we don't know. It's sort of uncharted territory, and that's what Disney's doing. Marvel and Disney is really good at building a branch. They're building a franchise here, and what they want is they want something that can launch the franchise. They do. Oh, they'd love it if it made $300 million. Sure. It's not going to because of the release date, and it's not very well known. What they're looking for is something in the $150 million range, something along the lines of what The Incredible Hulk made or the first Thor movie, the first Captain America, even Planet of the Apes and G.I. Joe, which are famous August tentpoles that made $160 million or so domestically. And they're hoping for the gravy to come in overseas, because even if the budget is $150 to $200 million, which is likely, it can crack $400 million worldwide and be a definite hit without huge numbers in America. This movie doesn't need to do huge numbers. This movie needs to crack $100 million. It can't be like John Carter, but I don't think it's going to be. It has to make well over $100 million, but it needs to, if it's topping out at $150 million, that's not a problem. And I mean, Disney will be perfectly fine with it. It's also, you have to remember, the last Marvel movie before The Avengers 2 comes out next summer. So it's your last chance to see the Marvel Studios movie. And it also depends on what happens with the movies later in July. If the end of July is kind of a bust in terms of big movies and moneymakers, this thing might just do well. I mean, it could bomb. And if it makes $50 million and done, then that's a bomb. But even if it's somewhere north of $100 million and pushing $150, especially if it has great business overseas, it's still going to be a big hit. So I don't expect Iron Man numbers, but if it's just, you know, if it's half or less than Iron Man, it's still okay. You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. And that music means it is time for the world famous DVD roundup. All right, the spotlight this week is the X-Men movies, because there's been so many of them. Like I said, there's been six. And if you've not seen them or you want to collect them, this is a great time to do it, because they've packaged them together as Blu-ray sets, because they're all coming from the same studio. And they are all within the last 10 or 12 years. The trilogy, you can get the trilogy on Blu-ray with all their special features for like $20. And you can get the entire series going from X-Men to the Wolverine on Blu-ray in a box set for like $33. But the only thing you got to be careful of is if you buy these Blu-rays, you got to be careful that you get the right set, because they've been releasing the complete series for years. So if you buy one that was issued in 2009 or 2010, you're not going to get First Class and the Wolverine. And it might likely be still $30 or $33. So you got to get the right ones. But these are worth checking out and keeping, and they still hold up on Blu-ray. They're a lot of fun. The other movies this week on DVD and Blu-ray, you've got The Monuments Men, which is the George Clooney film with him and like Bill Murray and Bob Balaban trying to save artifacts after World War II. Pompeii, which is not a very good movie, but boy, it's really cool when Mount Vesuvius explodes. That's a spoiler. Sorry about that. 3 Days to Kill with Kevin Costner having a last-ditch effort at his assassin game. There's also A Bat Last Night, which came out on Valentine's Day weekend. And that's the David Mamet play made with a primarily African-American cast. There's Warehouse 13 Season 5. That's a great little show that finally ended its run on the Sci-Fi Channel. We're checking out, it's a short season, so it's not as voluminous as like season four. There's like six episodes, but it's still worth seeing for to complete the series. Stinker of the week was Vampire Academy, because when this came out in theaters, they didn't even let the fans see it early. They refused to let anybody do it. Thursday Night Sneaks, which means it's probably terrible. That's it. Next week, we're going to be talking about Maleficent, A Million Ways to Die in the West, and Filth. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.